As many as 10% of all couples of childbearing age in the United States have difficulty conceiving a child. This represents over 6 million couples. Infertility is a condition defined by the inability to achieve pregnancy after 12 months or more of regular unprotected sex, and there's no other reason, such as breastfeeding or the temporary stopping of a woman's menstrual cycle in the months following a birth. There are many biological and other causes of infertility, some of which medical intervention can treat. Generally, infertility can be attributed to the man, the woman, or a combination of both. Good evening, and welcome to Health Matters. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz, and I'll be your host for this evening's show, where we'll discuss infertility, its causes, and its treatments. This evening in the studio, I'm very fortunate to be joined by Dr. David Vandermolen, director of the Arklatex Fertility and Reproductive Medicine Center here in Shreveport, Louisiana. Dr. Vandermolen is also professor and clinical specialist of obstetrics and gynecology at LSU Health Sciences Center in Shreveport and serves as the director of reproductive endocrinology and infertility. Good evening, Dr. Vandermolen, and welcome to Health Matters.
Good evening, Dr. Katz.
So, before we get started, could you please share a little bit about your experience and training that's helped you to develop your expertise in this field? What sort of training is required to be a fertility specialist?
Well, most fertility specialists in female infertility and couple infertility undergo 4 years of medical school, then a four-year OBGYN internship and residency, and then an additional currently three-year fellowship in further subspecialty training in reproductive endocrinology and infertility.
Okay. And is that something that you did here in the Shreveport area?
Oh, no, actually, it goes back a little bit in time. My medical school was at University of Texas Southwestern in Dallas, and my internship at University of Mississippi in Jackson, and my fellowship at Medical College of Georgia in Augusta.
Okay, very good. So in reading your credentials, I noted that it was the Arklatex Fertility and Reproductive Medicine Center as opposed to an office. What distinguishes your practice working at a center versus an office?
Well, I think in a center it's a broader spectrum practice. It offers a number of different treatments, and our center is not just a place for consultations, but we provide guidance towards treatment options, evaluations. We provide both medical treatments for infertility as well as surgical treatments. And we also provide the assisted reproductive technologies, which involve simple things such as intrauterine inseminations or the more complex things, including things like in vitro fertilization or in cases where required or desired embryo evaluation to rule out potentially severe transmitted disease.
Okay. So there's a lot of information there that I think we're going to get into. I guess what I was trying to picture was a center with a team of professionals, a staff, labs, things of that sort, as opposed to a traditional office building that you might think
of. Oh, yes. We have and of course, in addition to the waiting rooms and exam rooms, we have a surgical suite. We have a radiology suite where we perform on-site hysterosalpingograms and uterine and tubal evaluations. And, of course, we have a full-service reproductive laboratory.
Okay. So let's define infertility. I mentioned it a little early on in the introduction, but that was perhaps a little general. Are there different types of infertility, primary, secondary? How does a person know if they have fertility problems?
Well, the simplest definition of infertility is time-related. And as you noted, people that have less than age 35 that have tried more than a year clearly need an evaluation. It's reasonable to be evaluated. When at 35 and older, because of the effects of age, it's best not to wait 12 months, but 6 months is long enough.
Now, so you said try for a year. What constitutes trying? What's the frequency of sexual intercourse that would constitute trying? Should they be trying every day, twice a day, other day?
Fortunately, most people don't have to wear themselves out trying every day, because in reality, most people don't need to try. Very commonly, couples will have intercourse two or three times a week, just being themselves naturally. And that's actually often enough to conceive without doing any special efforts or quote, timing.
Okay. And if they wanted to increase the odds on their own, is there a particular time during the month that they should try?
Well, generally, you know, a woman will ovulate about 2 weeks before her expected menstrual date. Okay. So the best time as far as trying to time things would be to have intercourse every other day between 16 and 12 days before expected menses.
Okay. So if you don't know when it's coming, but you know when it's finished, how long would you wait after the menstruation was over before you'd start with that every other day
routine? Typically, if a woman's having a 28 to 30 day cycle, she's going to ovulate around day 14. So with those regular cycles, start every other day about days 12 and go through about day 16.
Okay. And the incidence of infertility, is that going up? Is
it? You know, it's not uncommon to hear people comment to that effect. But, you know, the actual incidence on an age-related basis really is not going up. Mm-hmm. Now, I think it's more recognized. I think it's more reported. People are more willing to talk about it. And to the extent that you have people that have generationally have become more work-oriented and delayed childbearing, there's been a shift to more infertility simply related to putting off fertility and then dealing with the problems of advanced age. But in and of itself, it's not been more common on a purely age-related basis.
So why do people become less fertile as they get older?
Well, unfortunately, women are only born with so many eggs. Okay, a woman actually has her maximum number of eggs at about halfway through her pregnancy. In fact, she's down from about 5 million prior to birth, about 2 million. By the time she has her first period, she's only down about 400,000 eggs left. And a certain percent resorbs every month, and you start to see she doesn't make new eggs. Mm-hmm. So it's around age 35 that the declining pool of eggs in both number and quality start to show up and affect pregnancy rates. And that's typically around age 35 where fertility, the monthly chance of getting pregnant, which is actually only about 20-25% in its normal state, when that starts to decline, and it falls by about half between 35 and 40. And then it continues to bottom out and tends to really bottom out around 43. Mm-hmm. There's a few lucky couples that will get pregnancies after that. You hear a lot of that in the media, a lot of times people who are famous, celebrities, that type of thing. But those later 40 pregnancies are usually done with donated eggs, which, of course, the couples don't mention for privacy reasons.
I see. Now, Abraham was 100 and Sarah was 90. So apparently the infertility issues have been going on a long time. Now, when might a couple consider turning to a specialist? Just after a year of trying, or is there some things that they can do on their own after a year that that they could, you know, they could pursue before actually coming to see a specialist like yourself?
Well, you know, just being aware of the normal coital frequency, if there's no obvious problems such as coital difficulties, having problems with intercourse or
What is a coital difficulty?
Well, couples that have had, in terms of, have difficulty having sex. Couples that severe premature ejaculation where the ejaculate's not making it into the vagina. Or couples where there's severe pain with intercourse, which prevents intercourse, for example. Or severe libido problems, erectile dysfunction, another part of a coital problem.
Okay. So you mentioned the women, they start to lose eggs and then by age 35 or so don't have quite as many available. How does that work with the men, though? Their sperm counts drop as they get older?
Male sperm counts start to drop a little bit after age 40, more so after age 50, but you really don't start to see much of an actual decline in fertility, the ability to father, until around after age 50.
Okay. And Viagra, which you see, Viagra, Cialis, and those type drugs, does that have any impact upon fertility in men?
only to the extent that it helps with erectile dysfunction and successful intercourse. Beyond that, it doesn't improve sperm counts or those types of things.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about some of the causes, common causes of infertility. Let's start off with the men. When a couple comes to see you, I understand that both the men and the women are evaluated. What are some of the common causes of infertility factors in men?
Well, in males, unfortunately, a lot of times it's unexplained. Mm-hmm. A lot of times there's unexplained underlying genetic issues which lead to low sperm counts or low sperm motility or abnormalities in shape and function. Now, there are some things that can be caused and not inherent, and obstruction of the vas deferens or of the epididymis, the tubes that take the sperm to the penis, if you would. Those in infrequent cases can be obstructed after infection or trauma, mm-hmm. Surgical trauma even to those areas. But it's just not very common. Males can be actually born, for that matter, without the vas deferens, that the tube that delivers the sperm from the epididymis to the ejaculate, that tube didn't form. That's a genetic cause. Severe alcohol abuse can lower counts. Marijuana use has a negative effect on sperm quality and function. A number of medications can have negative effects on sperm counts. And then the one that unfortunately we're seeing a lot these days is, quote, treatment for low T. Testosterone or similar androgen supplements done to improve libido and sexual function and that type of things suppresses the male reproductive axis, to where the brain, the pituitary gland that normally tells the testes to work and make sperm, it's no longer driven to do that because of so much extra supplemental testosterone. And counts can fall very, very low. And we're seeing a lot of couples with guys that have low counts and aren't aware that it's just due to the supplemental T they're taking.
Okay. Well, that's kind of ironic, you know, to hear that men are taking supplemental testosterone to improve their erections and their virility, and at the same time they're dropping their sperm counts. So we've got a lot of information to cover, but I do want to remind our callers, as our listeners as usual, that this is a call-in show, and your participation is welcome and encouraged. And we'll be taking your calls at 1-800-552-8502. It's 1-800-552-8502. Now, I had heard the time I was a child something about tight underwear and encouraged to, you know, men are encouraged to wear loose-fitting boxers. Is there anything to that? Is that still something?
Well, there is a little something to that. Of course, normally, anatomically, the testes are in the scrotum, which is actually external to the corpus, the body itself, and the body temperature, the scrotal temperatures, is a little lower than actually as if the testes were inside the abdomen, and there is a mild negative effect of temperature on testes and the sperm production. So, yeah, avoiding excessive heat. Boxers better than briefs. Looser better than tighters. Not tighter. Not spending a lot of time in the hot tub and sauna. Mm-hmm. Can have remove a mild negative effect on sperm production and quality.
Okay. And what about some of the causes that you see in women to explain infertility?
The most common cause of infertility from the female side is ovulatory dysfunction, not releasing an egg regularly once a month. Mm-hmm. It can be due to several things. That's most common. Then another area of cause is tubal or peritoneal factors, where there is damage to the fallopian tubes or damage in the environment around the ovary and the fallopian tube. Of course, you know, the egg is released from the ovary, and it's picked up by the end of the fallopian tube. If there's scar tissue such that the tube is blocked, well, the egg's not going to make it into the tube. It's the sperm aren't going to get out through the end of the tube and meet the egg. So things there are tubal obstruction due to previous inflammation from, say, tubal infections such as, quote, pelvic inflammatory disease or gonorrhea or chlamydial infections.
So sexually transmitted diseases that women might
to damage the fallopian tubes are those that could cause it. Now, herpes wouldn't cause that in and of itself, and HIV wouldn't in and of itself hurt the tubes. But unfortunately, those bacterial ones like gonorrhea and chlamydia that can damage the tubes clearly do. Now, another one that's not infectious, and it's just hates it, rotten bad luck, is endometriosis. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, is when the uterine lining, the endometrial tissue, grows not inside the uterus, but it grows outside of the body of the uterus, on the surface of the ovary, for example, or on the fallopian tubes, or on the pelvic peritoneum, the lining around those tissues. And unfortunately, it causes inflammation there, which in turn creates an inflammatory environment, which is harmful to the egg or sperm, as well as often leading to scar tissue again, which mechanically prevent the egg and sperm from meeting in the fallopian tube to form the embryo, which, of course, then moves back down the tube into the uterus.
So in both of those cases, how would you address that if you actually have a mechanical obstruction?
Unfortunately, fallopian tubes are very fragile. Okay, they're very fragile, and it's a simple analogy, but the normal structure of a fallopian tube, if you would, it's like a hollow noodle that's been cooked just right, and it's not too soft, it's not too firm, it's not soggy, and it's hollow, and it's lined by a fine, delicate, feathery lining, okay? Another way, think of it as a brand-new, fine, bristle paintbrush with multiple fine little bristles on the inside. Well, unfortunately, with inflammation due to, again, endometriosis or infection, you lose that fine interior architecture.
I see.
And it becomes lost. Instead of it being fine and delicate, it becomes smooth and flat. Okay? Instead of having like a new paintbrush that has all those bristles, it's like that old paintbrush that never got washed. So instead of 200 bristles, you got three great big ones, three larger ones that really aren't going to work. So it's not just the mechanical obstruction, it's the quality of the lining. Surgery can be done to open up tubes that are blocked near the ovaries, and you may get about a 1 in 3 chance of pregnancy after that. But too often, because of the interior damage, they don't work well. And more often than not, after distal blockage of the tube occurs, one end up needing to do the in vitro fertilization to bypass the tubes.
I see. Now, you also hear a lot in the news about plastics and the effect that plastics might be having on fertility in women. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Well, there are some compounds in plastics that are organic compounds that have some very, very mild similarities to estrogen compound structures. Okay, and so there's been some comments over time that such compounds could have negative effects on eggs and fertility. I don't know that the absolute evidence for that is very strong. I see it mentioned from time to time. Similarly, there's been comments over the years or data that certain talcum powders and things that when used for vaginal hygiene, etc., could lead to an inadvertent or some small exposure uptake even through the vaginal fluids in the fallopian tube and could have a negative effect on the ovaries and have an increased risk of leading to endometriosis. But you know, as far as routine daily things, plastics of things that people should avoid, there really is no good solid data to tell people, mm-hmm. well, don't use that container or you know, beyond just good common sense.
Okay. And how about some other factors like early ovarian failure or decline? Are there hereditary conditions, or do these sort of issues run in families? Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, and one of the more difficult forms of infertility to treat is when it's due to early aging of the ovary. You know, as we spoke earlier, the eggs decline at kind of a programmed rate, which is genetically determined. And there are some women that do have an enhanced earlier than normal decline of their eggs and their egg quality. Okay, that's that can be detected before it gets too severe. There are ultrasounds that can be done. There are blood tests that can be done. There's a quote anti-Müllerian hormone or AMH test, which is a measure of the number of eggs left, which is a helpful tool. And there's an egg a second or third day of a woman's period done that day, an FSH or follicle stimulating hormone, an FSH test that can help be a measure of egg quality. Mm-hmm. Those tests can be done for and we routinely do those when we evaluate for infertile couples to detect those couples that are experiencing that. Now, mm-hmm. causes of that, most often underlying genetics. Mm-hmm. Heavy cigarette smoking mm-hmm. can predispose a woman to that mildly. Okay, a woman that's undergone radiation treatment for cancers are certainly a much increased risk for that. And women that have undergone chemotherapy for cancers are certainly at high risk for that. And fortunately, along those lines, if time allows these days, prior to treatment of a cancer, we do have the ability to preserve eggs mm-hmm. and save eggs now mm-hmm. with the use of egg freezing. And that about 2 years ago, that was determined no longer experimental.
I see.
And use of frozen eggs is not associated with increased birth defects. So,
yes.
So there is the option that women can undergo a ovarian stimulation process, have her eggs pulled from the ovary, frozen for later use,
yes.
undergo her cancer treatment, and then use her eggs at a later time.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. You mentioned cancer treatment, and as a cancer doctor, we encounter this not infrequently with patients of childbearing age. And you know, it's a very sensitive topic. It's a sensitive topic. If you don't have cancer, or if you do have cancer, but fertility in general, I understand can be very sensitive, and there can be a lot of psychological issues associated with inability to conceive. And one of the reasons why we're very fortunate to have you on this evening is that we have a forum that people can call in. Questions that are on their mind or concerns, and they can do that in a rather anonymous way. Now, this is certainly not a replacement for a medical consultation, but if there's specific questions and that are on someone's mind or a couple's mind, and they'd like to call in at 1-800-552-8502 and call in a question, we'll be happy to address it. But you did mention the preservation of both the eggs and at the same time, I guess, sperm banking. And so for people undergoing procedures for cancer or for other procedures where there is a risk of infertility developing, tell us a little bit about what's the process by which somebody could have their eggs or their sperm banked or saved.
Yeah, the sperm banking is, of course, quite a bit easier. It's getting in touch with the clinic and then scheduling an appointment to have the man collect and then cryopreserve the sperm. And the cost of that are around $300 or so. And yearly storage is similar after that first year. So it's not a particularly expensive way of preserving the ability to father down the road. When it comes to, and I'd be interested in Sandy and hearing your comments about this, because, you know, egg freezing has been available for some time, but I'm surprised I haven't had more people contact me about that. And my observation or my thought is that I think a lot of times people are so overwhelmed with their cancer diagnosis that they're putting reproduction to the side, and just simply getting past their cancer becomes just the number one by far. And despite how important fertility and parenting down the road would be, you know, maybe you could comment on that.
You're putting me on the spot as the host. But yes, I think it's exactly what you said, that that it is overwhelming when you receive a cancer diagnosis, and it's enough to wrap your head around the treatment, and that in fact fertility and parenting issues do kind of take a second seat. And I think at the same time, it may be an uncomfortable topic for clinicians to discuss with their patients as well, because they may not really know how to handle some of these issues and some of the psychological aspects of not just dealing with surviving the malignancy, but the lifestyle changes that could result. So I think it's an area that is probably underserved, and it's one of the reasons why we're having the show this evening, to kind of promote that awareness. So, hopefully this will accomplish that, and yeah. You may be seeing more of that. You mentioned your lab and a number of services that you offer. So, what's the process? Let's say a couple is having problems with fertility. They've done the things that you've mentioned, and now they've decided they want to come in for a consultation. I imagine you perform a number of tests. What would be a typical workup for an infertile couple?
That's a very, very, very important question. The initial fertility evaluation looks at the most important basic factors. Of course, the patient comes in at the new patient appointment. We get a thorough history of all those things, menstrual cycle, pain, things that make us pelvic pain, painful periods, make us worry about endometriosis, for example, previous tubal infections, history of those types of things, previous pelvic surgeries, and of course, menstrual pattern. Family history is very important as well with respect to reproductive function. But a thorough history and exam, and then of course, do the exam. And an important part of the reproductive exam in fertility is the pelvic ultrasound, looking at the uterus size and shape, okay, looking at the ovaries size, number of resting follicles as a function of how many eggs are left, okay. And then we move on to typical evaluation, includes evaluation of the fallopian tubes, which...
How do you do that?
Which is typically with a hysterosalpingogram. Mm-hmm. It's an X-ray test done there to demonstrate the normal patency, that the fallopian tubes are open. And there isn't any type of obstruction there. The part of the female exam, of course, is to document that she really does ovulate, okay. That she releases an egg each month. So that's usually done with a progesterone level done on the correct day of the menstrual cycle, usually on a woman who has a 28-day cycle, done around day 21. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then the other important parts of the evaluation, of course, is the man having his semen analysis done. Mm-hmm. And then I think the other important part is the blood, the lab assessment, ovarian age, looking at the egg count number with the mm-hmm. AMH blood test, and then a day two or three FSH value to look at the ovarian egg quality.
Okay. And... what about some other issues? Do you ever have situations where there's intolerance or allergy to semen?
That is something that you see reported. I think in that situation, I think true allergies to semen are rare. Now, there are some patients that can have antibodies to sperm, mm-hmm. okay, that is actually more an issue of the male making antibodies to his own sperm. Decreasing sperm production, decreasing sperm motility. As far as women have an allergy to sperm, quote, women making antibodies to sperm, that's been controversial in the literature for some time. If it would exist, treatment would be intrauterine insemination. As far as like contact allergy to sperm and vaginal irritation, I think it's important to rule out underlying vaginal problems such as underlying yeast infections, bacterial vaginosis, other causes of inflammation, such as a latex allergy.
I see. Okay, so let's say you've done the workup and the tubes and all the hardware is working properly. The lab work all checks out. What would be the next step? Medication?
Well, if you're saying and asking me that everything seems to be normal,
yeah,
that's what you're asking me, then really the ovarian age tests are good. The ovaries are not small. The fallopian tubes are open. She's ovulating. His sperm numbers and concentration and volume are good. Then it becomes an unexplained infertility picture, which is about 10 to 15% of the couples. That's really what the underlying diagnosis is given. It's a recognized diagnostic group. Okay, so in that case, you know, and I certainly suspect that a number of women with unexplained infertility actually have a little bit of early ovarian aging and a little decrease in egg quality that we're just not yet able to pick up with our current tests. But that being the, and I think functionally, the way to think about unexplained infertility is really more about how often that couple is able to make a healthy embryo. And let me preface this with the idea that, you know, really no couples make healthy embryos all the time. Normal monthly chance of getting pregnant is not 100%. Normal monthly chances are only about 20 to 25%. You say, well, why is that? Well, a good bit of that is simply because often a healthy egg is not made. We know that one in five times the egg that's made doesn't have a normal half set of chromosomes. It doesn't have a normal half set of the genetic material it's supposed to have.
So it doesn't make it.
It's an egg, but it's not a normal egg.
Right.
It's missing a chromosome.
And what if the egg is normal and it's fertilized, but then it doesn't implant?
Well, that is, you know, one of the remaining problems that needs to be solved, and it's going to take some time, is the actual implantation process. Okay, and a very nice study was done in which IVF was done and embryos were put in the woman's uterus, and those embryos had actually been tested and shown to be chromosomally entirely normal. They were either 46XX females or 46XY males. So we knew they were, on the chromosome level, normal embryos. And in that case, putting two of those embryos in, the pregnancy rate was 80%, but it wasn't 100%. Mm-hmm. So there's still a 20% issue that up to 20% of the time it's due to an actual implantation error. That embryo, despite being making it in the uterus, mm-hmm. it wasn't successful at going through that process of losing its protein coat, okay, the zona pellucida, its shell, if you would, of actually then attaching to the surface of the uterus, of the uterine lining, of the endometrium, and then literally, like a little cache, if you would, literally burying its way underneath the surface, implanting, setting up its vascular supply, and setting up shop, if you would. And it's a dynamic process. Mm-hmm. And still, there's a number of proteins involved there that have been shown to be necessary. Leukemia inhibitory factor is one. There's probably a role for interleukin-6. There's a number of cell surface proteins that have a role there. No doubt the immune system has to have a role, because mm-hmm. we can ask ourselves, why aren't embryos rejected, like a donated kidney, if you would? Because
right.
half the proteins on the tissue proteins on that embryo mm-hmm. are foreign to the mom, actually. Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, and I like to say this many times, when we fully solve the problem of implantation and why it's not rejected, mm-hmm. that could have tremendous implications for transplantation medicine.
We have a question from a caller who called in and wished to remain anonymous. This is a gentleman in his early 50s who had a vasectomy 15 years ago and wanted to know if there was any possibility of a reversal after that long and at his age, and what other options might be available for him if he's given his situation, if he's looking to father a child.
Sure. Vasectomies can be reversed, but unfortunately with increased duration of time since the vasectomy, there's a chronic inflammation that happens where the vasectomy was done. They don't reverse well starting after about 5 years. By about 10 years' time, they reverse very, very poorly. The current American Society of Urology, American Urological Society Association, I should say, recommends not reversing a vasectomy after 13 years. And after 10 years is a common clinical rule of thumb, because unfortunately success rates are just very, very poor. You just don't get good healing. You get very low amounts of actual moving sperm mm-hmm. that are able to make it through that reversal site. So
what do you do?
So in that situation, the approach could be to actually do the in vitro fertilization process.
Okay. Let me stop you. You've mentioned in vitro fertilization a number of times. Could you describe what exactly in vitro fertilization is?
In vitro fertilization is a process where basically a lot of the natural steps are bypassed to make sure the eggs and sperm are brought together to form embryos, which are then placed in the woman's uterus. So in a nutshell, a woman goes through about 10 days of hormone injections to stimulate her ovary to grow not the normal one follicle and egg made each month, but to make about 15 eggs that month. Okay, mm-hmm. That's step one. Step two, with a minor outpatient procedure with anesthesia, IV anesthesia, using ultrasound guidance with a transvaginal through the vagina needle placement, the ovaries are aspirated of the eggs to get the eggs
so
out.
So you're able to suck the eggs out through a needle.
With a needle, aspirate the eggs right out of the ovary. Okay. Mm-hmm. Then step three is that those eggs later on that day, about 4 hours later, are mixed with the partner's sperm. Okay. Now, if the sperm quality and motility is good, they're literally allowed to co-incubate overnight, and by the next morning we'll have fertilized eggs or early embryos. Okay. Then the embryos, step four, the embryos are allowed to grow and develop in the lab over 3 to 5 days. And then with a small catheter, they're placed one or two embryos, typically in less than 35 on a first cycle. One or two embryos will be placed in the woman's uterus mm-hmm. where they can then implant. Mm-hmm.
And what if the sperm and the egg are coexisting, but they're not speaking to each other?
Good quality, yes. And in this situation, like the gentleman you mentioned, that what would be recommended is him having an epididymal biopsy to pull sperm from his epididymis, minor outpatient procedure again, under local anesthesia and IV sedation. He has his sperm retrieved the same day that shortly about the same time his wife is having her egg retrieval. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, the amount of sperm obtained is low, but it's more than enough for those eggs.
I see.
And then, because the number of sperm are actually low, we can, under the microscope, inject mm-hmm. one good, healthy, moving sperm directly into each egg. Or endocytoplasmic sperm injection, or ICSI. We can inject one sperm directly into each egg to make them fertilize.
So you can see a single sperm and a single egg and inject a sperm into an egg.
Under the microscope, yes, sir.
That sounds like a very specialized procedure.
Takes a lot of training.
Yeah, I imagine so. And so you mentioned you'd put two fertilized embryos into the uterus. Now, why not put more, 5 or 6 or 7 or 8? Would that increase your likelihood of having a successful pregnancy and possibly a reality TV show?
The key to trying to get successful pregnancy with IVF, related to how many embryos you put in, is trying to put enough to get pregnancy without simply putting more that give you just higher twins and triplet rates, okay? And so, yes, if you put more in, unfortunately, you could get an incredibly high pregnancy rate, but then your multiple pregnancy rate, twins, and especially triplets and quads, can go way, way up, and that's just not good because, as you, I expect most people know, those high-order pregnancies are very high-risk early delivery, with, of course, marked prematurity and then potentially very unhealthy babies, long-term sequelae, you know, mental retardation, cerebral palsy even from being born so very early. So we really want to avoid that. And again, the common less than age 35 IVF group, 1 to 2 is the typical number we put in on a first IVF cycle.
I see. Now, does that vary? You said that's the number that you put in. Do some clinics put more in than others?
Well, you do see some variation. Some clinics are more aggressive. There are some that are particularly aggressive, and they are frowned upon, frankly, by the majority of reproductive endocrinologists and fertility specialists. Unfortunately, we're all aware of the, quote, the woman giving the term, quote, Octomom, unquote, which was in a California clinic where she had requested her physician put in, I believe, 8 embryos. Mm-hmm. Okay. And actually, I believe it may have only been 6, but it was way too many, and 2 of them split.
I see.
Okay, I've heard 2 different stories there, but she put in, she requested far too many embryos to be put in, and the physician did it. And I think in that case, his professional judgment took a back seat to patient autonomy, and realistically, mm-hmm. it shouldn't have. He had the responsibility to not place that many embryos, and he didn't fulfill that, and brought him a lot of criticism in professionally for what he did, frowned upon by most of us by far.
I see. Again, I want to give the number out to the listening audience. We welcome your calls or comments or even experiences with infertility. That number again is 1-800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. So you mentioned again, Dr. Vandermolen, about a number of embryos placed inside the uterus. When somebody is evaluating a center, let's say they're dealing with fertility issues, they want to obviously give themselves the best chance of taking home a baby. How do they compare one facility with another? Is there grading? Is there certification, accreditation? Are the results published between one center to the next? Because it sounds as though you mentioned the skill and the expertise that's involved in some of these procedures. So I imagine that there's some variability between facilities. How would a couple evaluate centers and know where to go?
There are a number of different ways to approach that. The simple local reputation of a physician still has value. Looking at the physician's credentials, is he board certified in his area? That's, I think, an important step. Is his reproductive laboratory certified, such as, for example, by the College of American Pathologists, which is an important step? Does his IVF or does his or her IVF program participate in the Society of Assisted Reproduction Reproductive Technologies, or SART, okay, which is a society that most of the IVF clinics, reproductive centers belong to. It's a group that sets standards, and its membership requires that we meet those performance standards. In addition to that, reproductive clinics, IVF pregnancy success rates are published both via SART, that society I mentioned, as well as through the CDC. On their reproductive page, and you know, those IVF pregnancy rates are a reasonable measure of quality, but again, they have to be taken with. They're just one part of evaluating a clinic, because different clinics do see different patient populations, and.
So when you say see different populations, do you mean different populations in terms of the age of the patients, or is it that they're selecting out their patients?
It's different in several things. The IVF pregnancy rate as a measure of success, unfortunately, is two-edged. It does give some measure, but unfortunately, there are some clinics that almost become, because of competition reasons or marketing reasons, become quite focused on pregnancy rates and almost want to protect their reported rates to the extent that they don't necessarily allow couples with lower chances try. Mm-hmm. Okay. On the other hand, IVF pregnancy rates can sometimes look really good in a high income area where a group of couples for which time is more important than money, want to be very aggressive and move very quickly to doing IVF and not do some of the quite cost-effective but more time-consuming pre-IVF treatments.
Like medicine.
Like fertility drugs, to improve ovulation, to do increasing egg number and insemination together, Clomid insemination cycles, etc. Mm-hmm. So that clinic can through going quickly to IVF will have a higher success rate and look better than others, but it isn't necessarily better. It's a function of how they're practicing and that their patients want to be aggressive.
Okay. So we've discussed earlier how sensitive the topic is, and understandably there are religious there's some controversy. Some religions are a little less favorable towards assisted
reproduction.
Thank you very much. How do you deal with this if you have a couple that comes to see you and they have fertility issues, yet they're conflicted because of their faith, or perhaps because of a non-traditional couples. Gay, lesbian couples. In your practice, what are some of the ethical issues that you encounter and some of the social issues that you encounter?
I think one of the most important things in helping infertile couples is to provide them with a good evaluation, a quality evaluation of what the underlying problems are, the issues they're facing, and then what their treatment options are, how well they work, and what they cost. So couples have a clear, fair understanding of what their challenges are, okay? And in presenting that information in a gentle but honest, straightforward way, so they know we're dealing with. Now, having said that, you know, fertility is like so many things. One size does not fit all. All solutions don't work for all people. And within the context of a religion or financial or simply what, quote, someone's comfortable with, unquote, and for other reasons that you know, trying to maximize their chances. And you know, fertility care is something that's to be taken advantage of by those who want it, and to the extent that it fits in with their ethical and moral compass, if you would. We try and within what any particular couple is comfortable with, you know, we try and maximize what's available to them. But, you know, it's never something that's forced or coerced upon people. It's there if they want it and it works for them.
Sure. I guess part of my question is are assisted reproductive services available to non-traditional couples, non-married couples, single women, single men, gay or lesbian couples? Are they excluded from this type of medical service?
No, reproductive services are made available to couples of all faiths, of different gender identities, et cetera, and gender orientations, and most fertility clinics like ours provide that to people of these different backgrounds.
Okay. Now, what other options are there in situations where, let's say, there's been premature ovarian failure, let's say, and there's just in vitro fertilization is just not going to work? Are there other options, let's say, egg donors or surrogates?
Yeah. For couples that have premature ovarian failure, or markedly compromised ovarian reserve, where the woman is just not able to make quality eggs or eggs at all, then certainly there's adoption, which has its pros and cons, and then there is use of egg donation. And egg donation, generally, it's done using eggs from a woman who's donating them, of course, but who is less than 35, and usually will have a good reproductive history. And so the pregnancy rates using IVF with egg donation can be 70-75%.
Okay.
They go on baby rates per try, and they can do very, very well. You know, Louisiana law is a little unique in that it's considered illegal to sell eggs in Louisiana, so you won't have clinics that have, quote, anonymous egg donors available. But I have a number of women here, couples here, that have used, they're known directed donors. they have younger. That means that they've picked the person that they think will be their egg donor. It's not something we've picked for them. They have either like the younger sister of the spouse or a good just a good friend of the couple, that female friend, of course, that has been willing to donate eggs for them. And so they bring the couple to us, and that is not against Louisiana law. And a number of the medical components of this, be it known directed donor or quote anonymous donor, are the same. So we have a number of couples over the years that do directed donors. And one of my observations have been over the years is that, well, yes, a lot of women would not be comfortable donating eggs used to get babies by another couple. A lot more women, I think, are than might be expected. And I always encourage couples that are facing this egg donor choice to be willing to bring those questions up with women that might be willing to do so. They might be presently surprised.
So does the same thing apply for sperm donors? Do you get to select the sperm donor?
Sperm donation. Yes, there are certainly a lot more people willing to donate sperm than there are women. And technically, obviously, it's a lot easier. The issues with sperm donation, it used to be fairly easy. A couple could choose their sperm donor of choice. There was always an evaluation that involved screening for things such as hepatitis and HIV, body fluid, semen fluid, transmitted diseases. That screening was also done. With an increased level of legal scrutiny, if you would, by the Food and Drug Administration, of course, the U.S. government, it's become almost prohibitive to do sperm donation with a male that a couple has chosen to be their sperm donor. It can be done. The screening involves a full history and physical, with all extended government determined screening guidelines, and then they undergo a process of the full, again, body fluid transmitted disease screening, hepatitis, HIV, CMV, a number of others, and then the sperm is the man goes through a series of collections, freezes the sperm, and 6 months later the man is totally screened again.
No kidding. So it sounds like safety is paramount when you're talking about these sort of procedures with donors, which is very encouraging. So we talked a little bit about sperm donors, and we also discussed egg donors. What happens when you have unused embryos that are created?
That's an excellent question, of course. Most patients end up using all their embryos to get their babies, okay? It's not at all uncommon that patient does IVF, gets a baby from their first fresh embryo transfer, comes back a couple years or so later to use their remaining embryos. Now, so most commonly, or they went through their first IVF, they didn't conceive with their frozen cycle, but then they came back into their fresh cycle and got the baby from the fresh cycle. You know, fresh IVF or frozen IVF success rates are very, very good. We've running over 70% take home baby rates on our frozen thaw embryo cycles now in the last 2 years. There's enhanced success with a very fast freeze and thaw technique called vitrification. But yes, there are some cases where embryos are chosen to be not used. And then what happens? Well, patient options are to donate those embryos to other couples anonymously or direct donation so that the other couple can try and use those embryos to get a baby, of course. Or in most states, the embryos can also be donated for research, okay, like stem cell research, for example. Yeah. Or in most states, the couple can make the decision to thaw and discard the embryos.
Okay. And if you're using frozen embryos, is there a greater risk of birth defects in those children?
You know, there is not. There's been thousands of babies born from frozen thaw embryos. There's no evidence at all that babies born from frozen thaw embryos at all.
We have just a few minutes left, and we have time for one more call, and that's at 1-800-552-8502. You mentioned, Dr. Van der Molen, cost. Is this a healthcare procedure that is paid for by insurance companies? Is it an out-of-pocket expense? And how expensive is it?
In a few states, it's been mandated by the government to cover IVF with the health insurance. But most states do not. In most states, including Louisiana, it's fertility care is not covered by health insurance. Now, some of the diagnostic tests are covered. Oftentimes, insurance will cover the diagnostic procedure, but most don't cover treatment. So treatments vary in lower cost to the more expensive. The most common treatment done is, for example, Clomid and insemination, IUI cycles, run about $900 to $1,000.
So that's okay? Artificial insemination.
That's right. Artificial insemination done for a number of different fertility problems. Mild, moderate male factor, unexplained, a cervical factor.
I see.
And then for the more expensive treatment, of course, is the in vitro fertilization. Okay, and that runs about $13,000 to $14,500, medication included, for a fresh cycle. For couples that are fortunate to get extra frozen or extra embryos to freeze, then frozen thaw embryo cycles run about $3,000 to $3,500.
And what's the success rate, and how often do people need to do multiple cycles?
It varies by age and diagnosis, okay, and those types of things, but in our hands, IVF in the less than 35-year-old woman, we're seeing about a 62% take-home baby rate per try. Now, these are first try, second try, and third try patients. So you can imagine it's going to be a little higher in your first tries, and then it drops off. And I counsel patients that don't conceive on the first try. Generally, second try, it's going to be mildly reduced. And then, of course, we adjust the success rate as a function of what we learned about their embryos and their fertility potential in the IVF lab. Did I answer your question?
Yes. So this can be this can range anywhere from being a mildly expensive undertaking with medications and maybe even some diagnostic tests and artificial insemination, but it could also become a rather very expensive.
Could be quite
undertaking
expensive
if you're talking about multiple cycles of in vitro fertilization, mm-hmm, and the medications associated. So does cost become prohibitive for some of your patients where they reach a point where they've exhausted their resources and they're not able to continue?
I think cost can become prohibitive for a lot of patients. And, you know, this is not all that high an income level, economic level, as I know you know. It's like I like to say, we're not in Highland Park, Dallas, or Manhattan, New York City. So yeah, a lot of couples face some financial barriers, and it prohibits them from going farther in their care. Now, I do have to say though that there are some loan programs that are available with reasonable interest rates that can help couples finance their IVF, and I think that's worked well for a lot of couples.
Yeah, very good. Well, we reached pretty much the end of our hour this evening, and I really want to thank you, Dr. Van der Molen, for sharing this information with us and your time this evening with our listeners on a very important issue. Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all health questions, you should consult a physician or a health professional. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Production assistance this evening was provided by Wally Derleth, Henry Edwards, and Kermit Poling. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Dr. Sanford Katz. Thank you for joining us this evening.